Hello and welcome. My name is Michael Rodriguez. I am the subject librarian for English and American Literature and the collections coordinator for humanities in general for the library. I'm here just to say a few brief words about why the library does these sorts of things. And this one, we have a colloquia series, a film series, and a Michigan writers series. And so, of course, this is the Michigan writers series. And I was just asked, you know, what do we record these things, so where does that go? Well, here's my PSA for that. There's actually a Michigan writers series page. If you go to the library homepage and then the Google box up in the top right corner, you just type in Michigan writers series, you'll get several things, but the first thing that usually comes up, I think, is the actual webpage for the Michigan writers series. On that page are pictures and recordings of everything we've done for about the last 15 years. I think it started in 2000. Is that about right, John? 2000? Yeah, I think so. So we do interviews as well. So authors come to the campus and we interview them. The interview is there as well as the actual the audio streaming audio for the reading. And there's usually pictures. I didn't tell you that John's probably taking pictures too, but he is. So, and there's several other I especially want to thank the co-sponsor for tonight's event, co-sponsors, which are the English Department and Jensen. Jensen, we'll have another event with Jensen in early March, which is March 4th, which is Marge Piercy will be here. And there's several other Michigan Writers Series events later in the semester in April, where we're co-sponsoring with Residential College and Arts and Humanities to bring in for, so they're doing the readings the night before, and then they'll be here in the afternoon the next day to have talks with, I think it's just Terry Blackhawk and actually Carolyn Forche. So. Oh, it is? It's not Blackhawk?
Oh, it's Blackhawk and Heinrich.
I don't think Heinrichsen is going to be here.
Okay.
Right.
Sorry.
We changed that. So without further ado, Talena Erickson will introduce Robin Silberglade. So please welcome Talena from the Department of English.
It's an honor to introduce Robin Silberglade tonight for this reading. A mother, a daughter, a sister, an author, a poet, a professor. Robin's work resonates with anyone who has ever lived, worked, and parented in this world. It may especially resonate with anyone who has lived their life outside of the traditional narrative of relationship, marriage, children. Robin's work also resonates with those who live daily in a female body. Whether writing poems, essays, or memoir, Robin's creations connect wholly to our physical form, the way our bodies save us, and the way our bodies betray us. I tell my students that the best creative writing comes from wrestling with ourselves. In poetry and creative nonfiction, the most moving and true works always attempt to balance our dark and light. In Robin's darkness, there is infertility and miscarriage, two things that many women experience, but society, and sometimes even the medical community, ask us to belittle them or forget them. In Robin's light, her two beautiful children, her many publications, her passionate teaching. Robin's essays and poems reflect the depth and nuance of this dark and light, the humanity of an author whose writing illustrates both everyday joys like baking banana bread and reading a toddler a story, as well as the cataclysmic loss of a miscarried, much-loved, much-wanted baby boy. In her memoir, Texas Girl, Robin looks at a vial of blood that is being drawn to monitor her pregnancy hormones, and she observes, "Everything you need to know about me is here in this thick red blood." I would just add that she writes her words from that same blood, and all of her readers benefit from her truth. Everyone, please help me welcome my friend and colleague, Dr. Robin Silberglade.
Thank you. That was, get this out of the way, lovely. So I guess I should thank at the outset also Michael Rodriguez and Lisa Fine for organizing this event, as well as my colleagues in the English department. And I don't tend to be really chatty between poems and things, but I will say a few things, I guess, at the beginning and as I need to throughout. So whenever I read this work, inevitably at the end there's a conversation and I get asked about the rather intimate nature of my work and kind of how I do that. And I tend to answer something along the lines of if I'm asking that my students, right, tell the truth about things, and I don't mean that in a factual way necessarily, but in an emotional way, to put themselves out there in poetry or memoir or whatever they're doing, well, I need to be willing to do the same thing. So I guess that's the prelude to all this. So tonight I'm going to read some from the memoir that Professor Erickson mentioned, Texas Girl, and I'll read some poems that are in a forthcoming book, The Baby Book, and just sort of move back and forth between poetry and nonfiction just to mix things up a little bit. So I'm going to start actually with the first chapter of the memoir, so it needs absolutely no explanation because it's just the beginning. That's where I'll start. My daughter was conceived over the phone during a conversation with my on-again, off-again, something or other. At this moment, we were mostly off-again, given that he was living four states away. Still, he'd call me at odd hours, harass me about my early bedtime and short stature, and leave me wondering why I had spent the better part of graduate school fawning over him and buying overpriced lingerie from Victoria's Secret. There was something about his honeyed voice, coaxing me into doing all sorts of things I shouldn't do from the very first time we didn't go out on a date. The last time I'd seen him, I was sitting at my desk in the corner of the table, or in the corner of the kitchen where a table was supposed to go, pecking out the sentences of my dissertation on my laptop. The desk sat under the window that faced the outside corridor of the apartments like a cheap motel, and his face peered at me through the glass, long fingers held over his eyes like a visor. I felt like I'd been caught doing something incredibly private, putting one word after another in a slow seduction of language, Coltrane crooning on the stereo. I wondered what he saw when he looked at me, chewing my thumbnail, bare legs folded beneath me on the chair as I wrote. Did he see a woman he loved, or a painting by Modigliani, hands and breasts and mouth? I hadn't seen him in more than a month since the day he'd packed his books and copies of Esquire magazine and liquor boxes and headed to Texas to start a new job. He hadn't told me he was coming. I opened the door and buried my face in his t-shirt. We stood in the doorway a long time, not speaking. It was so quiet, I could hear a talk show from my neighbor's living room. He smelled tender, like talcum powder and laundry fresh from the dryer. He pulled me wordlessly to the bedroom where he peeled off my clothes like the skin of a precious fruit and took me to a place beyond metaphor. We did not conceive a child that night, but a single-celled idea implanted itself in the wall of my uterus and then slipped out painlessly like an early miscarriage a few weeks later. As I listened to the sound of his voice thrumming through cross-country phone lines, I remembered the weight of his body on top of mine, and I imagined holding a daughter who had his long toes and my eyes. Sometimes, like tonight, in the autumn air, crisp with possibility, she was all I could think about. The force of my desire surprised even me. I sat in my ratty terry cloth robe on the oversized armchair in the corner of my room while the cats chased each other back and forth across the length of the apartment. The last time he was here, I sat on his lap, my head in the eloquent curve between neck and shoulder, while he read poems from the books on my shelves, his voice warming me in places starved for touch. I missed him. I missed his late-night visits and roaming hands and the heat of his breath in my ear. I wanted to be with him, in his lumpy bed in a city loft, doped up on the sound of his voice, not alone in a student apartment with plastic covers instead of real storm windows to keep the chills at bay. I wondered where I'd be living in a year, if I'd be stuck in the same town in a state of prolonged adolescence, all of my 20s given up to the great writers of the 20th century, if I would spend my weekends as I did now, shuttling back and forth between the library and my apartment, checking out books about babies and home decor and hiding them under my bed like a teenager's stash of porn. At my feet lay page after page of job descriptions, professorships in creative writing, American fiction, women's studies. I imagined myself in a huge lecture hall prattling on about the conflict between work and family that still faced women today, and Sylvia Plath's choice to take her own life at the ripe old age of 30, and then coming home and eating tuna fish, giving the cats the juice from the bottom of the can, and watching TV until colors fizzled into migraine. Something in the vicinity of my uterus cramped. "Did you see the one for Grinnell?" he asked. "That looks perfect for you." "Yeah. You don't sound particularly enthusiastic." He was doing that thing I hated, playing pop psychologist, echoing back what he heard me say. "I just want to have a baby," I think is what I said. "You're 27. He said it in a way it could have meant anything. "You're 27, so wait, you're 27, so of course you want to have a baby." He was good at giving those sorts of indefinitely interpretable answers. I called him Dr. Boy to my friends. No, what I mean is, I don't think I want to do this job thing. What I didn't tell him was that my dearest friend from grad school had just sent me a chipper email telling me she was expecting a baby in April. I looked up her due date on a website that gave information about each week of pregnancy. This week, it said that women who are experiencing nausea might find relief in eating high-protein snacks before bed. "Well, you can't exactly be a stay-at-home mom if you're not married." I'm not sure what I wanted him to say, but that wasn't it. I didn't want to be married, and I certainly didn't want to be a stay-at-home mom with a brood of toddlers tugging my knees and dumping grape juice all over the carpet. He kept talking, and as he talked, there was a flash of clarity, bright and honest as orgasm. Something in me shivered and burst open, something beyond narrative, beyond the predictable life story of man plus woman equals baby. And in the words that traveled across the phone lines, something marvelous began to take shape. When I got off the phone, I flushed my birth control pills down the toilet. This time next year, I could be somebody's mother. So I'm going to read a few poems and then go back to a meatier chunk in the book. Sorry. So I see a few of my students out there in the audience, so this should be somewhat familiar to them. I frequently ask that my students write list poems and poems that contain objects, and well, this does both. And it's also an abecedarian, so for those of you who aren't poets, that's a poem that takes the shape of the alphabet, so the first word of every line, you know, moves A through Z, so you'll probably hear that. This is also a sort of ode to online shopping and consumer culture. So it's called Over the Internet. A-rated car seats and alphabet magnets, books on pregnancy, birth, and baby care, covers for shopping carts, cloth diapers, disinfectant, Desitin, email receipts and encouragement. Everyone says, "You're so young, you have nothing to worry about." Fertility guides for every blood type, a Fisher-Price farm, grandma's Fussbuster CD for the baby who won't sleep, hypoallergenic formula for when the CD doesn't work, inflatable ducky tubs with free vinyl patches, Jenny Lynn cribs from Pottery Barn, antique blue. Kindness comes on dry ice, kosher chicken and roast beef from D. Like you, she has lost a child. Like you, she sometimes forgets to eat. Mother's margarine for Passover, medical profiles of philosophers, chemists, 21-year-old screenwriters from Napa, Ned the garden gnome, a gift from Vermont for the nurse, ovulation test kits with their second lines clear as an oracle, pink and blue pacifiers, Playtex nursing bras, qualitative HCG tests that never turn blue, roses for the hospital nightstand, sanitary napkins and tampons, thermometers and bulb syringes, tiny plastic combs, undergarments for new mothers, just in case, vial upon vial of injectable drugs, Vitex and vitamin E, white onesies in five different sizes, Zytex's catalog, a xylophone, years' supply of Pampers from eBay, books on Zen and the art of infertility, plastic zoo animals marching two by two. So I guess you could tell from Talena's intro, the story did not go as planned. Life usually doesn't go as you want it to go. So these next poems sort of set the stage for the middle chunk of the memoir. This first one is called The Miscarriage, which is actually a diagnosis of a miscarriage that has not yet happened but is impending. And it has an epigraph from the book Unspeakable Losses by Kim Kluger-Bell that reads, "It is impossible to gauge the depth of grief either by the size of the coffin or the circumstances of the loss." The miscarriage. For 12 weeks, I lugged him everywhere I went, belly swollen, 9 pounds, this grief. The weight of a child smaller than a grain of rice. On the sonogram, my uterus a dark cavern, empty. This is what desire looks like. In the nurse's station, she drew tubes of blood, papers saying I knew the drug could cause a birth defect, methotrexate, for killing unwanted cells. My son was wanted. The placenta that nourished him kept growing, cake baked with too much yeast. The nurse waited for me to pull down my black tights, to lean over the table, shifting my weight to my right. For days, my body ached with knowledge of what we had done. The child she helped me conceive and then took away. After, my body made milk for him. If she hadn't stopped it, it would have let him swallow me whole. Sorry, my work is not light. So this next one comes from a chat book that I have called, the book is called Frida Kahlo, My Sister. And it uses Mexican painter Frida Kahlo sort of as a point of triangulation between my own experiences of reproductive loss and dealing with some family history and my sister's experience with kind of physical and mental disability. So important facts to know about Frida Kahlo if you don't know her. So she was in kind of catastrophic streetcar accident in adolescence. So that's one. Two, her work is primarily self-portraits, and a number of them feature kind of not only kind of, I guess, pain of the female body in various ways, but also her own history of miscarriage. So this is called An Open Letter to Frida Kahlo. When my legs were dumb from the DNC, when my feet were heavy, stirruped balls of cotton, and I couldn't tell where they stopped, and the blankets began, I thought of you. They kept putting more blankets on me. They were white, and everyone else wore green, my doctor in her scrubs standing between my legs. I'd been there before in your painting, dear Frida, and there were wires attached to my chest, and there were tubes run between my legs, and Dr. E sucked it out, him out, my boy, I mean. And I thought, if this scene were a painting by Frida Kahlo, it would be beautiful. And I laughed. The sound filled the room like a newborn's cry. Frida, what I wanted to say is that I understand why you come back to this room, a hospital in Detroit, why the paintings pin you there to the bed like a bug on a nail, because you're still there. You left pieces of yourself behind, a blot on a sheet, some tissue in a jar, and you want them back. Okay, we'll read a little bit more prose and then switch back to the poems, and then hopefully I'll save some time for questions. So this is the middle section of the book, and it's a fairly disjointed section of the book that moves pretty quickly through several months in time. So if it seems disconnected, it's that way in the original. But I'm also excerpting it. So, it was a hard winter. Though it never snowed more than an inch, ice coated the streets and bridges from a series of storms, and I wondered if I'd ever go anywhere again. On TV, the local news showed one car sliding into another blocks from the clinic. I was a passenger on a plane in a holding pattern, circling the Oklahoma panhandle, desperately hoping to make my connecting flight. 3 months off, Dr. C had said, checking off more tests on a requisition form, thyroid function, natural killer cells, anti-nuclear antibodies, antiphospholipid antibodies, 9 vials in all. My life stood still, like my car with its doors frozen shut in the campus parking lot. Do you think she'd asked me that day in the recovery room, her hand praying on my forehead? Do you think it's been so hard because you're doing this alone? Her voice was soft, motherly. In a few minutes, she'd leave me and go home to her own family, wrap Christmas presents, bake cookies with her daughter. Her question punched the tender spot in my abdomen. If I had a husband, he would have held my hand before the anesthesiologist inserted the IV. If I had a husband, he would have cried with me in the sonogram room or written a poem about the child who wouldn't be. If I had a husband, he would have taken me home after the procedure and tucked me into bed. If I had a husband, nothing about the experience would have been the same. I clung to her voice because she was the closest thing this baby had to a father. I wore grief like a winter coat I couldn't shrug off. Was it harder because I was alone? There's no way to know. I'd wanted the baby so I wouldn't be alone, so I would always have someone with me, dance partner, comrade in arms, so at night there was the sound of someone else's breathing in the dark. I'd tried to create a family for myself and I'd failed. I didn't accept failure. I wanted to call up the cryobank, order some more samples, try again. It was fall when I'd gotten pregnant, the leaves just beginning to turn. By the time the doctor let me try again, the ice had thawed and the crocuses had burst through the ground. Valentine's Day. While my students picked up packages and flowers were delivered to campus offices, I drove down the highway in my black suit. It still didn't fit, but I sucked in my waist until the zipper mostly closed, added a safety pin to fasten it and a raspberry-colored shirt to hide the pin, getting dressed for the closest thing I had to a date, an appointment for my annual exam. I drove slowly, my hands clenched on the wheel, erasure played on repeat on the car stereo, past the hospital where I lay numb on the table from the chest down, past the hospital where the doctor scooped my insides like an avocado overly ripe and sent them to pathology to be tested. There were 2 angry scars on my left hand from the IV. I wondered if they would ever go away. V-Day. My students sold cookies shaped like vulvas in the union and brought the leftovers to class. Last night, Nona and I sat through their performance of the Vagina Monologues, the theater bright with paintings for sale. Our Texas girls dressed in pink and red. They wore feather boas and top hats. They took back the night, decorated cookies with pink frosting and paint. Driving down the highway, I thought, if my vagina had a monologue, this would be it. "Hey, Robin," said Dr. C, like we were old friends. Under her lab coat, she wore a gray pleated skirt that swished when she walked past. Her heels clacked against the floor. She didn't look like the person who had cut a child from my body, wearing blue scrubs and booties that covered her shoes, only her eyes visible over the mask. Today, she was Catherine, a woman who was once a girl like my students who had grown up in small town Texas, who had swapped Valentine hearts with friends. I wondered what she would have thought of those vagina cookies. I wondered if tonight, after she'd seen all her patients and picked up her kid from school, her husband would take her to dinner and hold her hand. I joined her in another one of those bland offices with a couple chairs and a small desk with a computer. The computer was new. "So," she said, sitting back in the burgundy chair, "I think we should talk about injectables." I swallowed. She stared me down, cleared her throat. "What are you afraid of?" What I didn't want to tell her was that fertility patients took injectables, real fertility patients, those who spent years trying to get pregnant before they found their way to her office, not me, not a 30-year-old who'd never really tried to conceive in any systematic way, but had the convenient diagnosis of infertility merely because of the lack of sperm and wickedly low progesterone. What she was telling me was she really thought I needed help. It was a whole different game than 11 months ago when I sat in her office and she said cheerily, who knows, you might be fertile myrtle. Robin. She took her glasses off. They dangled from a chain around her neck. You made a decision at 29 to get pregnant and raise a child on your own. She cleared her throat again, searching for words. That's bold. I nodded. It was the closest thing to a compliment she'd ever said to me. That's the hard part. Injectables? She shrugged. You can do this. Okay. The word caught in my throat. If this were fiction, if I could write this story any way I want, I would leave out most of that winter. I would ignore the days I cried behind closed office doors and the nights of self-pity, drinking colored drinks that gave me headaches and smashing glass on the porch. It was trite. All I needed was a freezer that gave out endless cartons of Ben & Jerry's ice cream, and I'd be every depressed girl in every Hollywood film. Only those girls were usually depressed about men, not about not having babies. I don't know any movies about women not having babies, not really, because not having babies is really boring when the heroine isn't smashing glass on the porch. Other than that, it's a lot of time in doctor's offices and waiting rooms stacked with magazines about babies and a lot of vials of blood stopped with rubber caps. But what happens when the story is true? What happens when the heroine decides at 27 she wants to be a single mom and she gets pregnant finally and then she has a long drawn out miscarriage and spends a couple months being depressed? What kind of story is that? If this were a film, there would be a montage set to moody music, a series of melancholy shots. A woman dressed in black driving down the highway, a woman in black in her bathroom filling a syringe, a woman in black standing in the lecture hall, a woman in black getting her blood drawn. Still, there were moments that were wildly funny, like the time the resident said Dr. C might want me to have sex after my HCG shot. I stared at him, dumb. What did sex have to do with getting pregnant? Oh, I finally said, you know I'm using an anonymous donor, right? The new plan involved shots, lots and lots of shots. I had enough needles, I thought, to supply the entire town. They came in a large box, individually wrapped in plastic, along with a small box filled with teeny tiny vials of injectable drugs. I kept them in the top drawer in my bathroom with a bottle of prenatal vitamins and my paperwork from the clinic. Treatment for patients with antiphospholipid syndrome, updated 2000. Dosage of heparin to be increased throughout pregnancy, platelet count and calcium level monitored, monthly sonograms to check fetal development, increased risk of stillbirth, increased risk of postpartum stroke, heparin to be stopped prior to induction of labor and recommenced 12 hours before birth. I didn't believe in fate. I didn't believe in it will happen when it is supposed to happen. I didn't believe I lost a child so I could have the one I was meant to have. I didn't believe in anything but the drive. While driving, I made lists of baby names. While driving, I gave imaginary lectures to my students. While driving, I thought about my father. While driving, I thought about my mother. While driving, I wrote drafts of poems. While driving, I wondered how long I would keep driving. So I think, read a couple poems to close. So one of the things that this forthcoming book, the baby book, does is tries to reclaim some of the medicalized language having to do with infertility treatment. And to do that, one of the strategies I use to do that anyway is making use of various persona. So these next two poems take the perspective of just various medical personnel. So this is called The Phlebotomist. And if you don't know, that's the person who gets to draw your blood. And I actually know someone who is studying to be a phlebotomist, which I find a little freaky. Anyway, The Phlebotomist. When people ask, she says she's a modern-day vampire, drawing vials of blood and stopping them with rubber caps. It's how she lives, feeding off strangers to buy groceries and pay Cable One. Sometimes it's a girl who needs a pregnancy test. Sometimes a man in a blue suit worried about HIV. She knows all the codes, diagnoses for anticoagulation therapy and infertility. The woman who comes in at the same time every month with lovely veins, boxes for progesterone and prothrombin time checked on her form. The answers swirl in her blood, illegible as food coloring or finger paint. All she can do is pray. All she can do is roll the dark tubes in her hand. This is called The Andrologist. She always wanted to be a boy, admired their shirtless chests in the summer when she was bound by a bra. They had swagger, bravado, their jean shorts slung low on skinny hips, the bottle of beer they held to their lips. She is one of them now, cocksure, as she pulls the vial from the tank. In the waiting room, patients sit in their chairs, patiently waiting for her. She spins the vial, lets the dead matter sink to the bottom. It's pretty and pink, like the waiting women brushing their hair, fixing their lipstick, reading American Baby. She escorts them down the hall, leads them like a first date. Behind the door, they will undress. In the lab, she watches them swim. So this next piece is called An Open Letter to Our Sperm Donor. And this is a poem. A lot of the poems in this book actually have been retitled from earlier things that were, I think, more graceful and less obvious. But as my students know, I'm sort of a fan of the blunt title, and it can serve some useful purposes. So anyway, An Open Letter to Our Sperm Donor. Our daughter looks like me, people say. The architecture of her eyebrows and pointed stare. But in the photograph of you at 13 months, our baby's toothless grin after she's grabbed the cat by the tail. Every child, you said, needs a mother who reads, and each night I let her suck thick cardboard illustrations, Big Red Barn and Goodnight Moon, while I balance her on my lap. If you lived with us, you would know this. Perhaps you would bring me a cup of tea while I nurse her on the couch, a book of poems open nearby. Sometimes I wonder if you wonder about us when you're at work in the laboratory or when you're feeding your new son a bottle. The stories of our children are woven together. The tapestry couldn't be more beautiful, filled with these widening holes. I think I will end with a kind of prose piece. It hovers somewhere between fiction and nonfiction and is all over the place. And I taught a class, I'm gonna see a couple of the students in the audience last semester, called Flash, and it was just short form prose. So we kind of straddled the line between prose poetry and flash essays and flash fiction, and we're all over the place. So this is sort of for them. It's called The Mother. The mother is at the grocery store, putting formula and diapers in the cart, organic milk and cage-free eggs, the Greek yogurt the girl takes every day for lunch, and the cracker she keeps in the car for when it's 5 o'clock, the car ride home, and the kids are screaming for a snack. She pushes the cart through the produce department, the meat aisle, the dairy case. She pushes the cart past the beer and wine, past the frozen pizza and appetizer stacked in the 20-somethings' carts. In an hour, they will be at home, and the children will be bouncing a ball in the living room, whacking it with a drumstick, hitting the TV. One of them hides the remote from the other, and NPR on the news, while dinner simmers in the pan. And when they sleep, she will sit on the porch with a friend, drinking Moscato or a mint julep, thinking of how long ago it was she sat here, waiting for good news, wanting everything that today seems too loud, too fast, too much. The mother is making dinner. Today it's green veggie pancakes and meatloaf. Today it's curry rice and chicken. Today it's potatoes with rosemary and lemon. She slices the vegetables, dishes simmer on the stove. She could enjoy it, but for the children pulling at her legs. Mimi, up, up, up. Children so hungry they can't wait to eat. So hungry they don't know they're hungry, but she does. She can see it in their dim eyes. She's their mother after all. Slice some carrots, dip them in hummus, pour herself a glass of wine. The days used to be easier. Now she makes dinner at noon sometimes, when no one is home, no one to get in the way of her knife. The mother is driving. She is taking the kids to soccer or gymnastics or swimming. She is taking the cats to the vet, the computer to be repaired. She is getting an estimate on car repairs, on fixing the furnace, on having dead trees ripped out of the yard. She is driving to school, to camp, to daycare. She is driving, and they are hitting each other in the back seat. They are fighting over space, over snacks, over toys. They want the radio on, the air conditioner on. They want the heat off. They want the music off. They are putting their knees up. They are throwing garbage on the floor. Their car seat straps are too tight, too loose. The sign says 3 out of 4 children are not safe in their seats. The sign says it is inevitable that someone get hurt. It is 10:20 p.m., and the children are awake, rolling in their beds, the baby with his leg caught up to the knee, the girl staring out the window, reading Harry Potter with a flashlight. Once she took pictures of them sleeping, the girl from small to big with a line of drool on her pillowcase, the boy with his butt up in the air. They call it child's pose for a reason. Once she took pictures of them sleeping, but too often the flash woke them up, and sleeping is the best part of the day. When they sleep, she can pretend. She can dance in the kitchen. She can call a friend on the phone. But now there are dishes in the sink and toys scattered across the living room and children awake in their beds. It is 7 a.m. and the children are awake. They pull up the covers, they yank on the blinds, they look out the window at the yard. Mommy, the baby says, deet, deet. Mom, the girl says, there's a rabbit. They hit each other with pillows. They fall off the bed. They hold up bruised elbows and knees. Ow, they say, owie, ow. They straggle downstairs. They eat oatmeal and eggs. They bring board books to read and homework to sign. Mommy, they say, mama, mom. Their kisses are wet on her cheek. The dampness stays with her all day. Thank you. So I would be happy to take questions, or you can buy books in the back and I'll sign them, whatever you want to do, it's all good. Or not, whatever. Yes, Mr. Beers. I want to make sure I get your question because I didn't hear it quite. So are you asking if it sort of gets obsessive and you just keep,
yeah,
like...
Yeah, kind of become obsessive and feel like maybe you're repeating yourself, like the subject matter.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So I've got, I mean, you could tell, right? I mean, I read poetry, I read a chunk from a memoir, and it's like, it's the same subject matter, and there's actually... when I was figuring out what to do, I realized that, like, there's some lines that I have that, you know, it's like self-plagiarism, just go back and forth. There's just images, right, that I really, that I like. They work for me. And we've talked about this in class. I mean, I think obsession is, it can be a useful thing, right? I mean, just to get you to, like, focus in on something and explore it from any number of angles. So, yeah, I definitely feel that. It could tread the same ground over and over and over, and then it's like you're done with it, you know? But I think, like practically speaking, some of the ways of dealing with that for me are just coming at it from like different angles, either different voices or different forms. So, you know, I use sestinas and closed forms and things like that. So just like make the form new if the content is like the same old stuff. Does that help? Yeah, okay. You're welcome. We did not have a light day in class. It's like a lot of death and murder and stuff, huh? Anyone else?
There's books for sale in the back from, I always forget the name of it.
Everybody Reads.
Everybody Reads, yes.
Y'all do. You should.
So,
yeah.
Robin's more than willing to sign.
Yeah.
So, any other questions? No? Then thank you very much.
Thanks. And thank you guys for braving the weather.